The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio. Keep your mission on your mind, and your mind on your mission. This is Mission Minded with Michael Coleman.
Hey, 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 it's a Wednesday. That means it's time for Mission Minded. It's time to keep your mind, your mission on your mind. Of course, to do it with Michael Coleman. He is a non-for-profit expert. How long have you been doing non-for-profits, Michael?
Probably about 15 years now.
All right. We've got some great emails. You go to TonyCurryRadio.net. TonyCurryRadio.net. It's Curry with a K. Become a bonehead, and then you can leave emails and make them in the attention of Mission Minded or Michael Coleman, and we'll get to those emails. And I want to get into some emails right off the bat. Can we do that?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so Tara in Knoxville writes, with inflation, possible recession, is there ever a good time not to start a non-for-profit? Do you look at, you see how your economy's going before you actually start, or if you're passionate about it, any time's a good time to start a non-for-profit? Go.
Well, as with most of my answers, it is a yes and no.
Gotcha.
Very, very few things in life are black, found as I get older, are black and white. So if you're going to have people that are going to come behind you in a serious way with financial backing, those are going to be people that aren't so much affected by when inflation creeps up because they have enough money and enough savings, enough backing, enough financial wherewithal that things like that don't really affect how they invest and what money is available to them. Where it does impact you, though, is as you build your donor base, and I will tell you just from experience, when we see cost of living go up and we see other things affecting the economy, if unemployment rises, a lot of those people who would send us $10, $20, $30 a month do so out of excessive dollars that they have. And when they're having to put gas in their car, they don't have any extra money left over.
Yeah.
And so that causes those people who want to give, but they just don't have anything to give. So if you're starting a nonprofit and you're really passionate about it and you really think it's going to be something that's going to impact the community, something that's really going to fill a gap, then don't let the fact that it's a bad economic time stop you from doing that, because if you can make an appeal to the right people and sell them on your idea, then the financial backing ultimately is there. You just have to get to the right person. If you're trying to grow it from several people giving you $10, $20 a month, that's very difficult, very challenging, and especially in an environment such as this.
There you go.
So I hope that helps.
Yeah, it does. Michael Coleman, of course, he's on Mission Minded. We do it every single Wednesday here. You hear the show live on Tony Curry Radio. But go to Spotify, search Tony Curry Radio or Mission Minded with Michael Coleman, and you can listen to all of our previous episodes. I think we got like 20 or 30 episodes up, and go back and listen to all of them. They're fantastic. They're all different. We have topics, and of course, we've been getting into a ton of emails over the last couple of weeks. I got two emails here, one from Bart and one from Tom, and this is certainly topical. I was coming back from Atlanta yesterday to pick up a friend from the airport, and on the side of the interstate, I must have seen 100 different tents for homeless people right off the interstate. It broke my heart. And Bart basically said, how would Michael Coleman handle that issue? If you were driving down the interstate 285 and you saw a bunch of tents off the interstate, how would Michael Coleman handle it? And then I'm going to go ahead and piggyback it with Tom from Birmingham. He said, when is a passionate issue turned into a city issue? And how do you deal with the city in those particular cases? I know that's a very broad question, but you got it.
Yeah, so I've dealt with this issue with the mayor of Birmingham. I've touched on it on some other episodes, but he really asked me that question. He said, Michael, how, if you were a city, and I think he meant by that, if you were the leader of a city or if you had the power to solve this problem, what would be your approach? And the city does have some obligation, because you have an obligation to the taxpayers to make sure that the taxpayers are safe. If I have a business downtown and there's a downtown population that's loitering or begging for money all the time, well, that affects my business. That affects my livelihood. that affects revenue that I can bring in because customers will avoid coming. So there's a lot of things that can be couched as callous. Oh, you just don't care about the homeless. But no, I've got a business to run, and I don't want homeless outside my door harassing my customers, harassing my staff, and all that kind of stuff. Now, this is what I told the mayor. I said, my purpose at the Jimmy Hill Mission was to create an environment that anybody who sought help would be able to get not just a place to stay, but all the care that they needed. In other words, we're going to be able to get you mental health, physical health, all that kind of, all to be able to do that, but to help you advance forward in life. And so it's very time consuming. It requires a lot of resources. But if you have a place in your city, then what I think the obligation is to make sure that that person has an opportunity to get a hold of those resources. Because what's very difficult to understand is when you come across a homeless person, everybody's going to tell you, yeah, I don't want to be on the street. I want a different life. And when you engage them in conversations, my history has been that it doesn't take too long to tell whether they're serious about wanting to change. Because if they were on the street and didn't want to be on the street, and you offered them a place to go that's safe and is protective, and they can be fed, and they can provide provide them a pathway to move forward, then they'll jump on that opportunity. But the majority of people who are on the streets, and again, I'm not saying this to paint them in a negative light, but the reality is that you have to face is they're on the streets, and they are not, if given the opportunity, they are not willing to come off the streets. Now, in part of the reason is sometimes they're dealing with addiction issues. And I would say the majority of those are dealing with addiction issues. And when you get past the addiction issues, you say, well, why is there so much addiction? Why is there so much addiction and homelessness? Well, because most of the time when you dig down, you'll find out that there's past traumas in their life. And that could go back to their childhood. They were sexually abused, physically abused, emotionally abused. They've had these different things that happen to them, and they don't have the skill set or the mental wherewithal to be able to overcome these and cope with these effectively. So what ends up happening is they end up using substances to mask that pain, to just cope with it. And the reality is most of the people who are homeless have family members who love them and care about them, but have said, hey, I can't do life with you like this while you're, you know, while you're drugged out, or while you're, you know, using alcohol, you become abusive yourself and all of that. And so they separate from them. And so that's what you see. You don't see all of that that's led up to the homelessness. You just see a homeless person and you think, oh, if I could get him a place to stay, that would solve his problem. Or if I could get him a meal, that would help him. And it's so much deeper than that. I love the fact that people look at the homeless though and still care, because we need to care about each other. Those people are not, they're not the bad guy. Mm-hmm. It's too easy. It's too intellectually lazy to say, oh, they just don't want to work. The reality is that they understand the rules of that world. They know how to navigate that world, and they'll tell you it sucks.
Yeah.
But to offer them something different in which they don't know is a scary thing. Like, they know how to live on the streets. They know how to survive. They know how to stay in addiction. They know how to do that. To offer them a pathway to sobriety and a self-sufficient, productive life, they don't know how to navigate that world. And it almost is counterintuitive. You say, well, that's crazy. But they're like, no, I'll take this crazy that I know versus what I don't know. And so that fear of what does my life look like if I begin this journey can overwhelm them as well. So I know I kind of chased rabbits on this, but let me get back to your core issue. What do I do? I think we ought to be informed about what is the healthiest place to take them to, and do our best to get them either connected to that place or carry them to that place. There's nothing wrong if you say, I want to give them $10, or I want to give them some water, or I want to give them some food, or whatever. There's nothing wrong with that. You just need to understand you're not inherently going to change their life by giving them things. That's not the solution. And so then the mayor asked me, as we talked further about it, well, what do you do with those people who don't want help.
Yeah.
And so we talked through that, and I said, listen, it is not the taxpayers of Birmingham's responsibility to take somebody who comes from Dallas, Texas, and ends up in Birmingham for whatever reason, and now harasses the people in the streets of Birmingham, doesn't want help, has been offered help, but refuses help, and lives on the street and brings blight to the area, you know, trash and harassment and all those things. That's not a healthy life for them. So I think the most effective thing to do is to take that person and say, where's your nearest living relative? And let's say it's in Chicago, that person's in Chicago, Illinois. You put them on a bus to Chicago, Illinois. Even contact their family to help reunite them. But that's more compassionate than leaving them on the streets in Birmingham where they have no help and no connections, nor do they want any help. So it's an extreme – I'm trying not to oversimplify it. It's an extremely complex undertaking when we deal with homeless, the homeless, because there's not just one problem. It's several problems. And even then, governments, city governments, tend to focus on how the problem manifests itself. So the problem is manifesting itself as this homeless person doesn't have enough to eat. So we think, oh, I'll get them food. Or they don't have a house. Well, I'll put them in a shelter. But that's not their problem. But that's how their problems are coming to light. The problems run much deeper. And in order to deal with that, you have to develop a relationship of trust. It takes time. It takes energy. It takes patience. It takes loving people. And the average person doesn't have the know-how or even the desire to for that to take over their life. And when you're helping people with that much need and that much dependency and need that much hand-holding, it can overwhelm you. And so lots of times people will give $10 because it makes them feel better, and they leave because they're like, I can't give this person everything that they need. And I understand that. I'm not, there's no judgment there, but the reality is that's not going to help them get to where they need to get to.
Michael Coleman on Mission Minded. Keep your mind, your mission on your mind. Of course, you can hear the show on Spotify. It's free. Just search Tony Curry Radio and Mission Minded. You can listen to all of our previous episodes and binge listen to them as often as you want. It's a fantastic show. Of course, it airs live here on Tony Curry Radio every single Wednesday as well. It's got to be incredibly frustrating because, you know, we've seen this in AA. You know, alcoholic can't make another alcoholic stop drinking. You have to want to do that. And so I see that frustration point. And I'll take it from a biblical passage. You know, Jesus went out on the streets, right? He would go out and find the difficulties that we deal with on a regular basis. You've been doing non-for-profits for over a decade and a half. Do you find your heart being stretched a little bit from I'm here to service you, but also from a proactive standpoint? We got all these cities. I mean, every major city, and I just mentioned Atlanta, has got its own homeless community. And you want to fix that, but if they don't want your help, what do you got to do to protect the citizens and the taxpayers of that particular city? We have now drug dens in New York City where if they know you're going to use, you're welcome to come here and use your own personal drugs here. How do you deal with the proactive part of it in your heart?
Yeah, so I've seen this in nonprofit leadership. It happens a lot where you're dealing, you have such compassion and you get into it with such high hopes. I was watching a movie the other day, and they've done this movie 1,000 times. You know, a white person who cares about urban city school systems, and mm-hmm. you know, they go there and the person gets rejected and they come back and they keep doing it in the end, you know, they make it work. But that's because that's a real life. Even though they made that movie 1,000 times, the idea is there are people in society that care and that are passionate. And I've seen this all the time. People say, well, I'll start a nonprofit and I will just delve into the depths of this problem. And what they find is, it's way more complex with 1,000 more variables than they ever understood. And what happens is they become disillusioned, even to the point of, well, why am I doing this at all? I'm not making any sort of impact. And so that's why it's so important for people to understand before you delve off into an issue, you need more than just passion or that more than you just care about the issue. because they are incredibly complex issues, and you need to you need to be able to define what success is. Now, this is where I came in this process, because I was encountering this as I stepped into the nonprofit world right away. I wanted to make a huge impact, had a big heart. But there was just slapped with reality that not everybody wants my help. Not everybody wants my some people were looking at me as this white savior, or having a white savior complex. And so they were resistant to that. So I had to really say, you know, what does success look like? And so how I had to kind of change that perspective in my mind is I said, I'm going to be faithful to every day showing up and being the best person I can and caring for people the best way I know how. And sometimes that's speaking to them with tough love. Sometimes it's lifting them up and giving them food and water. Sometimes it's crying with them. Sometimes it's scolding them. It's doing what I believe is in the best interest. And so I want to be faithful to that. I don't measure my success by necessarily the transformation that takes place within individuals, because I can't control that. I can't control whether somebody wants my help. I can't control whether somebody takes my offer of assistance. But what I can do is know that I've encountered people, I've loved them, I've cared for them, I've been faithful to that calling, and that's all I can control, and that's all I can do. And I can leave there even though, like you said, sometimes it's a maddening process. But I think what it does is it keeps me from developing a hard heart. Yeah. I see beyond the problem. The average person goes, oh, look, they're on the street. And a businessman may say, hey, this is not a good look for our city. Some people may look at it and go, oh, this person doesn't have a home. And I'm seeing way beyond all that. I'm knowing that there's a deep down core issue that needs to be resolved that cannot be resolved in a five-minute conversation. It's going to take round the clock residential treatment, residential care, and somebody involved in their life that can counsel them, help them develop new coping mechanisms, giving them a new perspective that's willing to invest in their life for the long haul. That's what it takes to take out all that ugly. I have a great illustration for you, the one I've used for years. If we're a little kid and we're running down the driveway, and let's say we fall and we skin our knees, and that's happened to all of us, and we look down and we got little pebbles all in there and dirt and the blood starting to come up. Well, imagine if you didn't clean it or anything and you just went and put a bandage over it. Well, it's likely not going to heal right. It's going to get infected. It's F pus and all that kind of stuff. And so that's what you're seeing out there in the homeless community. Is people have been wounded, they've been hurt, but they don't know how to heal from it. And so they've had to continue on life. 11-year-old girls who've been sexually abused by their father or by their uncle or by a teacher and have been told they can't report that because the father's the breadwinner in the family. Just on and on and on we see these kind of tragedies. And so basically they just have to cope with it, but they don't know how to, and it comes out later on in life. And that's what's happened. So there has to be a time where you can sit somebody down, take the bandage off, treat the wound, clean it out, and let it heal back as the body intended. You have to do that with their life processes. And that's the only way to deal effectively with the addiction, to deal with the barriers that are keeping them from living an otherwise normal life.
This is a mission-minded. You can hear it every single week with Michael Coleman. Of course, he's been working with non-for-profits for well over 15 years, and he's the man when it comes to starting up your own non-for-profit. We also talk about other business stuff, too, as well. Spotify is where you need to go, TonyCurryRadio.com, TonyCurryRadio.net, just Tony Curry Radio Podcast, and search mission-minded. You can listen to all of our previous shows, and, of course, you can also hear it live right here on Tony Curry Radio Wednesday, twice right here. Stephanie in Garden City sounds like she's got a good problem. She said, what happens when you start a non-for-profit and you don't need any more funding? How do you continue to brag? How often does that happen? How often do you continue to brand yourself? Do you continue to ask for funds even though you don't need them? And I don't know how much she's over the top in the black. There's always a rainy day situation. Maybe she's serving a purpose that doesn't really need to be served. I don't know, but it sounds like a lot of people are passionate about what she's into. But what do you do, and then what do you do with that money?
Yeah, so we were running quite an excessive my last year here at Jimmy Hale. We had significant amount of money that we finished over and above what our budget was, to the tune of about $800,000. And so that's a great question, because some people would then just kind of tend to coast. And I think that's a mistake. And let me tell you why. I subscribe to the idea that you're either growing or you're declining. And some people feel like, hey, I'm in the sweet spot. I've got all the money that I need. I'm just going to continue to offer this service. And what I believe is that you always, as a leader of an organization, you always have to be looking to the what's next. Even if that what next is 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road, and you need to be building towards that. So, like you said, Tony, the first question I'd say is, okay, so what happens if the economy collapses? Mm-hmm. An ideal situation is you would have 1 year of operating funds. So if you have a $3 million a year budget, you would like $3 million in the bank for a rainy day fund. Because like you said, the worst case scenarios that could happen, and it could be something you're not expecting. It could be, yes, I have plenty of donors. I have plenty of income right now, but let's say, a staff member does something, or you have a huge liability issue, or somebody, does something that brings a poor reputation to your industry, in other words, and to what you're doing to your business. And so things that you're not even thinking about right now. So there's always that possibility. You have some sort of huge scandal that happens. And so you can see funds dry up. The other thing is, with donors, if you don't feel value, if you don't feel like, hey, I've got plenty of money, and you're not seeking donors, the human tendency is to not value donors as much, because I don't really need to stay connected to you, and donors will feel that.
Yeah.
And so you'll begin to, and so if you do need to ramp up, then the problem is you've lost potential donors. My best advice in that is to think about the most dynamic vision you can, because if you've got plenty of money, and even have, it sounds like, the capacity to bring in more, I would be looking at what you do, and I'm not talking about adding to your mission necessarily, but it could be adding capacity. So let me give you an example. We were creating a new paradigm of how you do addiction recovery and homeless recovery in Birmingham, and we were getting the budget as streamlined as possible. And then we thought, okay, well, we can't just exist and raise $1 million more a year than we're spending and just putting that money away. That's not why people are donating money. But after we got where we wanted to be with our rainy day fund, the question would then be, okay, we would look at, is there more demand for what we're doing in Birmingham? So if there's more demand and we're not able to meet the demand, then that's an indication I need to expand services. So put the money in and create more of what we're doing, because the demand calls for it. However, if I'm meeting the demand, then the question, and I've got this product or this service that's really benefiting my community, but I'm satisfying the needs in my community, I would look at what communities desperately need that, and I would look at launching in those communities. So you're never going to me, it should never be a position to where you're like, oh, I've got enough. And because I believe if you're doing something effectively, and it sounds like you are, it sounds like you're offering a great service that people are on board supporting, I would look at, okay, are we meeting all the needs in our community? I would spend some time in that. And if not, I would invest those dollars towards expansion. But I would also look at, okay, no, we're meeting the needs of our community, but you know what? There's other communities that don't. It may be a big community. It may be a small community that has this need, but doesn't have the money to be able to support that agency. And so you can take the excess money there and support other places and collaborate with other organizations as well. So I really encourage people to stay out of that mindset of ever getting complacent, because when you get complacent, you will begin to down the vine, and you may not see it initially, but you'll look back a year or two or three, and then you're like, okay, wait a minute, our donations are kind of down. Let me start reaching back out to my donors. And you start finding out there's some disconnect, and your donors have gone on and they're supporting other things, and you may not get that money back.
There you go. There you go. Mission Minded with Michael Coleman. You hear it live every single Wednesday right here on Tony Curry Radio and Spotify. Search Tony Curry Radio, Mission Minded with Michael Coleman. You can listen to all of our previous episodes. We've had a lot of talk about board members. We know you have to have at least three if you have a non-for-profit. And Tanya from Louisville wants to know what's the power structure. She's heard in previous shows that board directors usually don't get paid. The executives do. But how do the votes go down? If you have perhaps an executive director or anyone that's an executor or a director on a board that is getting paid, what kind of power do the board members get? And she specifically says, how do you get rid of a board member if they're not really in the loop and they're not maybe showing up to board meetings and they're just kind of being a little burr under the saddle? How do you get rid of a board member? And is there legal ramifications of that?
Boy, we could do a whole show just on that question.
Yeah.
I'll give you a Reader's Digest version, and I believe it was Tanya that wrote. And Tanya, if I don't answer this sufficiently, please write back with a clarifying question, and I'll be glad to tackle this again. Because I will tell you something, you have hit on the number one struggle right now in the nonprofit world, is you have professional executives who typically are understand the business or the service in which they are addressing, whether it's homelessness, whether it's healthcare, whatever it is. And then you have a board of directors, which by law, it needs to be there. And what they are supposed to do by law is they come on and they are the ones who are supposed to be ensuring that the director and its staff are following within the boundaries or guidelines of the organization's mission statement. So if we say we're here to lift up the homeless and homeless is our focus, well, wait a minute, they look up and the executive director's over here getting involved with the Girl Scouts. Now, the Girl Scouts may be a great organization, but that's not part of the mission. And so they're supposed to exert authority to do things like approve the budget. But it's about bringing accountability to the executive director. And why do you need that? Well, especially because I started a nonprofit, I felt like, hey, this is my baby. Well, I needed a good board who would come alongside of me and in a relational type way. And those are the best of situations. Would say, hey, Michael, here's some things. They would question some decisions I make. They would bring accountability, and everybody, I don't care how good you are in the business community, I don't care how good you are at delivering services, everybody needs that person in their life that's going to bring accountability. And so that's what a board of directors is supposed to do, is bring accountability, bring resources, and to be a partner in guiding the organization forward. Unfortunately, the reality is that's the exception rather than the norm.
Does it take a special person to be a board member? I mean, I would think that there's politics, there's ego. Hey, listen, I'm bringing in more than this person is, and I'm sitting here doing this job for free. Does it take a special person, just a passionate person, to be a board member?
Yeah, the board members typically are recruited, and you do that because they've had success in life. And yeah. And a lot of people will say, you know, you can boil it down to where you want somebody on your board who has influence or affluence. Yep. And so, you know, either they can write a big check, and typically they can do that because they've been successful in business, but also maybe they can't write a big check, but you know what? They have a vast network of people, and they can open up doors for the executive director to continue with fundraising. And so that's the influence or affluence, but you want successful people and people who are passionate about your program. And so they are not the experts of how to run a program. That's what the executive director is. The problem is that lots of times people don't know how to handle authority. So you'll have some board of directors who are micromanagers, and they cross all these boundaries into the operational piece, which is not their role. And so you'll get conflict between the executive director and the board chair or other board members, because they don't understand their role, or they're not executing it effectively. And lots of times that can come across as, well, the executive director doesn't want any accountability. No, the executive director knows he's been hired to do this job, and here's the board member's job, and the board member's trying to get over into the business of the executive director. And so there's conflict. And I'm recently aware of just two examples where the executive director was let go as a result of conflict with the board chair. So yeah, that's that. And so that goes to answer your question. Can the board fire, have the ability, and the answer to that question is yes, they can fire the executive director. And that is because that's part of the accountability. If the executive director acts outside of the law or acts outside of the mission, or if you're in a right to work state, you know, that maybe there's just a personality conflict, well, then you can fire the executive director. Now, are there ramifications of that? Well, if it's a popular executive director, if he's been there a long time, if he's very successful,
sure,
people say, wait a minute, I'm donating money. Why are you firing this guy? I like this guy. And so they have to answer those questions just like you would in any organization.
So how difficult is it then to get rid of a board member if you just got someone that's being a pickle? Is that something that's voted on by the board as well, or is that by the executive directors?
It is. Well, see, I've been in boards who didn't have processes in place. So a good board will establish when you onboard a new board member, you need a very clear onboarding process. So it would be something like this. For you to be voted on to come onto our board, you have to understand that you have to be a financial supporter. Now, you can determine, hey, you have to be at least be $1,000 a year supporter, or you don't have to give any amount. You say, but you have to be, this is a requirement, you have to attend. You can't miss more than two board meetings in a row. Here's the expectations. The expectations, and some boards will say you're expected to bring in $5,000 in donations, or you're expected to sponsor this or do this. And so you write those expectations out very clearly. And they become part of your bylaws. And when that gets voted on and that gets codified, then when a board member violates that, Then the board chair just follows the process. Here's another dynamic though. There is such a leadership void out there, and you will have people who come and end up being the board chair. Lots of times, not because they want to be the board chair, but there's nobody else willing to take it because nobody else has the time or wants to devote the time. And so they don't have a backbone. And so you'll have people who aren't invested, got on the board. Hey, it's not for them, but they won't quit. They stop showing up to board meetings. Well, this person just doesn't have the intestinal fortitude to tell somebody, hey, we voted, you're off the board. They don't want that conflict. They don't know how to deal with conflict. And so what happens is you'll have, you know, 60% of your board show up enough for a quorum to make votes, but the rest of the people aren't engaged and there's no accountability. And you as an executive director can't necessarily do a thing about it. I mean, you can talk to your board chair, you can inform them. The healthy boards are where the board chair and the executive director are on the same sheet of music. They're working together. The executive director is supporting the board. The board is supporting the executive director. The board understands there's very clear expectations and they're written down. And any board chair who understands, hey, we're very serious about what we do. This is not a resume builder for you. You're here to serve. And when it becomes evident that you're not ready to serve, you will be asked to step down. That's the kind of what you want to establish. You want to have a high standard. And I've seen boards that are more interested in like diversity. And I'm all for diversity, but sometimes you get diversity and you bring people on a board that don't add any value. They don't have any special expertise. They don't have deep pockets. They don't have any influence in the community, but they may check the box off. And so you're bringing people on that are really not adding anything. And then you're saying, wait a minute, these are the people that I'm supposed to entrust the decision making too. My career is actually in the hands of these people who may or may not even be invested. It's an incredibly frustrating and maddening process. So it is essential that you work with your board chair, or when you're developing a board, is that you have very clear expectations coming on, because they can, in fact, at any moment decide that you're not the leader they want, and then and they replace somebody and put you in there, and you have no standing, even if you created that nonprofit yourself.
Hey, Michael, you're a pretty passionate guy, aren't you?
Yeah, man, I start talking about this, and I've been involved in this stuff, and I have friends that are involved in it, and I had a recently just a friend I was talking to just last week. He was on vacation, was killing it in terms of fundraising, in terms of making a dynamic impact, but he had conflict with his board chair, and the board chair called him on vacation, and he was removed.
That's how they fire people on radio when you go on vacation. Yes. That's why radio people never go on vacation. I've seen more radio people get fired on vacations than anything else. Hey, listen, we're out of time, man. Great stuff. Keep the emails coming. Great emails here. Go to TonyCurryRadio.net, TonyCurryRadio.net, and you can leave your emails, become a bonehead, and we'll get you covered up here. And, of course, listen to Mission Minded every Wednesday here on Tony Curry Radio. Get that Tony Curry Radio app. If you're listening on Spotify right now, which we hope you are, you can listen to as many shows you want of Mission Minded as you want. Michael, as always, I love you, and I'll catch up with you next week, okay?
Hey, enjoyed it. Just one more shout-out to the people out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen. I hope this is beneficial. I try to make it very practical and things that will help you. So please continue to send in the questions, because it lets me know what's of interest to the audience and how I can help you in any way. So please, that helps us. So we'll just keep sending them in, and we'll tackle anything you shoot our way.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.